So I'm going to condense a one semester course into a few minutes. Oh, I'd like to introduce His Holiness Purangachit Swami. He's a ISKCON sannyasi, very young, because he's younger than me. And he's from Brazil, from the Belo Horizonte, not Belo Horizonte, from Pouso Alegre. Yeah, he's from Brazil and has served as a leader in the Hare Krishna movement in South America and also in Europe. Very old friend of mine since Physic London. 1976, he joined our movement in Brazil, so I've known him since then. And he'll be spending some time here in Gainesville. He's actually staying right here in the compound, so I urge everyone to take advantage of his association here, and he's a very nice guy.
He's my good senior.
So, religion. There are various, you could say, mundane attempts to explain the phenomenon of religion. It's a very remarkable thing about religion, because if you think of it, other aspects of life, you can study human sociology, psychology, economy, physiology, and so on and so forth. But perhaps the most remarkable thing about this phenomenon, this historical phenomenon of human religiosity, which has played an absolutely central role in human history. It's played a central role in human history, and arguably it has been the source of human moral systems, the fact that we live as civilized human beings, when we do live as civilized human beings on those occasions, rather than as absolute savages, although America, within the first world, is kind of the leader of social Darwinism. But still, to the extent that we live in a civilized way, to the extent that we voluntarily accept moral principles and so on, you could say historically these systems of moral values tend to come from religion. The source of our moral values has not been historically secular social contractarianism or something like that. So what's amazing about this central phenomenon of human life, religion, is that it is focused not on the earth at all, but on a realm which actually is beyond this world and non-empirical. Because religion in general, the powerful religions of the world, tend to talk about a reality which is not merely here on the earth, which is beyond the earth, which is not necessarily even perceivable by our material senses. And the fact that something which is superficially invisible and beyond our ordinary experience has actually been the source or the inspiration for probably the greatest literature, architecture, music, and the moral systems of the world. All these things coming from something which is not even from this world is very remarkable. And so it's undeniable that human beings have been, in the most powerful possible way, inspired by their conviction that the highest reality, the most important things in life, actually are beyond this world. So, another point is, nowadays we talk about economy. The word economy, of course, is generally applied to let's say the trading of physical things, you know, business and so on. But actually, of course, the word economy has a broader meaning. Economy simply means, you could say, that there is a supply and demand. And there's a demand for many things. There's not merely a demand, let's say, for cars or electric toasters or whatever. There used to be a demand for real estate in this country, but that's, of course, a memory now. So, but there's also a demand for religion. There's a demand for religion. People, there's a demand for inspiration in terms of what is my ultimate destiny, where do I come from? When people that I love pass away, where did they go? Did they go anywhere? Do they still exist? Is there anything I can do beyond all the material gains that we make, like, you know, health insurance and trying to feed our family properly? Are there other, more, even more powerful things we can do to protect the people we love? Such as securing blessings and so on. Are there powerful forces in the universe that can somehow or other be persuaded or mobilized in our favor? And so, India, and this is a point I always make at the beginning of the course I've been giving on the religions of India. India, I think, objectively, is, I would say, is the best place in the world to study religion for three reasons, actually. The convergence. There are convergence of three factors throughout the history of India, which have made it a unique place to study religion. Do you want to come in?
Maybe everybody can stick as close as possible and leave this area open because there
will
probably be many people coming to this board.
Especially when it gets near the time. So, as I was saying, India is probably, I'm sure, the best place in the world to study religion because of the convergence of three factors. One is that I think more than any other place in the world, if you go back very far in ancient India, in the history of India, as far back as you can, there was actually freedom. Thousands and thousands of years ago, India was actually in the respectable sense of the word, liberal, a liberal free society. There was freedom of religion, there was freedom of speech, there was a political freedom which was practically unimaginable in other parts of the world. For example, if you read Mahabharata, one thing that always struck me is that people, when they were dissatisfied and therefore so inclined, would simply go out into the street and criticize the king. For example, when Dhritarashtra and his son, Duryodhana, conspired to murder the Pandavas, their cousins, people knew about this. People suspected what was going on, and they criticized the king. And there's not the slightest hint in these ancient texts, there's not the slightest hint that that was against the law, or there would be any possible recrimination or reprisal against them. They simply criticize the king. He's a fool, he's a murderer, whatever. People actually had their freedom. There was religious freedom. We find in the Rig Veda the notion that the absolute truth is one, but it is invoked in different ways by different people or by different sages. So there was religious freedom. There was political freedom. And so on, at a time when these things hardly existed in the same way in other parts of the world. So the first factor is that India was a free society, even many thousands of years ago. Number two, there were always a lot of people in India, not like today, but India, in terms of the land, this very rich country, it has an extraordinary, perhaps the best river system in the world. There are rivers everywhere in India. There is fertile land. There is every imaginable climate because you have the highest mountains and then you have jungles at sea level and deserts and hills and everything in between. So it was a very hospitable land for human dwelling. So you have a good population, a large amount, a number of people. You have a free society. And there have always been a lot of very intelligent people in India. And therefore we find, for example, thousands of years before we find it in other parts of the world, an extremely sophisticated study of language. We find that India is one of the two civilizations in the world that independently developed a comprehensive and systematic philosophical system. And in terms of theology, it was always, I mean, there have always been some very smart people there. So when you get these three factors, you get a lot of people, a lot of intelligent people, and freedom. And I should add one more. There has always been a strong interest, a strong propensity toward spirituality and religion in India. As one scholar put it, Iliadi, who was one of the most famous scholars of religion in the 20th century, that the first real depth psychology, the first real systematic and very profound study of human consciousness took place in India within the practice of yoga. So India was, I think, realized long before it was understood in Western philosophy that whatever view we have, whatever philosophy, whatever faith or conviction, it is mediated by consciousness. It is through consciousness that we come to various points of view, and therefore, in order to understand the validity of any system of thought, we have to understand consciousness itself. And so in India, there was a very serious emphasis on the study of consciousness and on the study of epistemology. There's a sense in which I found Western philosophy, especially nowadays, and Western academics in general, to be almost unbelievably epistemologically naive. In other words, how do you ascertain that a particular type of knowledge is valid? Not necessarily, for example, that this or that claim is true, but what kinds of knowledge are valid, and how do you justify your faith in that kind of knowledge? I mean, basically, in India, people understood that there is obviously pratyaksha, empirical knowledge. I mean, it's not that you have to be very bright to figure out that we learn some things by opening our eyes and listening. So, pratyaksha, there was empirical understanding, there was anumana, inference or induction, and shruti, hearing from authority. I mean, if obviously, going to college is simply an example of shruti, right? I mean, you go to college and you listen, and you may dispute certain points, but basically you listen. So that's shruti, hearing from authority. So anyway, in India, of the five great world religions, great here in the neutral sense of having a great impact on human history. There's many philosophers roaming about the streets of Gainesville. Remind you of old Athens. Anyway, so of those religions, two of them, of course, came from India, Hinduism and Buddhism, and other religions, of course, are many, Jainism, Sikhism, and so on, many things. But, I mean, Hinduism itself, what we now call Hinduism, actually is a whole constellation of different traditions which shared certain common assumptions and therefore spoke to each other and developed, you could say, in association with each other as an aggregate of traditions. So, again, because we find this tremendous diversity and a full spectrum of human religiosity, every conceivable kind of human religion is actually found in India. And if you study the whole history, if you go back to the earliest Vedic teachings and the earliest Sanskrit literature up to the modern time, if we trace, for example, the history of Buddhism and other things, what really, at least what really struck me, is that despite every attempt to negate it, every philosophical, theological, intellectual attempt to refute it, over and over again we find in human religion the resurgence and the ultimate predominance of some type of personalism. And I'll explain what I mean by personalism. At the present time, if we just consider who we are and what it feels like, what it means to be a conscious entity in this world, we are persons. Each of us is the individual center, is an individual center of consciousness. And that consciousness includes volition, we have will, we think, and we have feelings. So each of us is an individual center of consciousness. Each of us is a person. Now, when you come to the conclusion, as philosophers in India did, actually, when you come to the conclusion that the world, as we ordinarily observe it, in other words, let's say someone is not the best and the brightest, someone is not very thoughtful, not a meditator, not a philosopher, doesn't really think deeply about anything, just concerned about where'd you get that, and how much did it cost, and so on and so forth. The way the world appears to such a person, the way the world looks, is not the way the world really is. The superficial, the surface observation that we make of the world is not the whole story. There's more going on there. Just to give one simple example, when we look at the world, everything appears to be sort of permanent, like this is a house, and this is my body, and that's my car. But even though these things appear to be permanent, they're all changing, they're all temporary. So this dichotomy, this gap between our ordinary emotional response to the world and the way it really is, we tend to think things are permanent. So we're startled when someone passes away. But actually we know everyone has to pass away. So Yudhisthira, the great Dharmaraj, was once asked at the that incident at a lake where he had to save his life and the life of his family, he had to answer all these questions, these riddles, very high-stakes riddle games. So one of the questions was, what is the most amazing thing in the world? And Yudhisthira answered, Ahanyahani bhutani gacchanti hajamalayam chesha sthavaram ichanti He said that every day people are going to Jamalaya, Yama Sadhana. In other words, they're dying. They're going to the abode of Yama, Yamaraj. Every day people are going, and yet the people who are still left here are trying to permanently establish themselves. Stavaram Ichanti. They're trying to find a permanent situation here. In other words, even though every day people are dying, people that are still left are hoping not to die. And then Yudhisthira said, Kimacharya Matapura. What's more amazing than that? That people think they won't die. So that's an example of how our psychology, our emotional state, does not exactly correspond to reality. Or, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna teaches that there is an all-pervading spiritual reality which underlies the material reality. Or, for example, the very fact that you are conscious. Again, to quote Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, that you are dehi. We are all dehi, not deha. Deha is the body. Deha means sharira. So Krishna explains that we are not the sharira. We are shariri. We are dehi. We possess the body. And the example he gives is Komara Jovanam Jara. Everyone has experienced childhood, youth, old age, Jara, in Sanskrit, from which we get the English word geriatrics, right? Gerontology. Anyway, so the idea is that you are a child, an infant, then a child, then an adolescent, and yet it's still you. The body's changing. It's not the same body. That infant body did not simply stretch. That's not why you're an adult now. Because your infant body just stretched. It's a different body. As they say in German, er ist, was er ist. Right? You are what you eat. So we are constantly recreating the body. We are reconstructing the body. And therefore, I, the consciousness, and not the body. So, as I say, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that you're not the body. Now, if I'm not the body, if I'm actually consciousness, and if therefore the world as I regularly perceive it is not the highest reality, if there's some, then the question arises, what about me? What about me as an individual person? When I become enlightened, when I see reality as it is, will I still be a person? Will I still be individual? What will I be? Or do I just merge into some... Is the appearance of individuality itself an illusion? Now, what's interesting is that if you look at the great traditions in Indian history, I mean, certainly one great tradition is Buddhism, which at one time had a very powerful presence in India. Buddhism arose in India, of course, and there was a time when not only Buddhism, Jainism also, they were very powerful. They were real serious contenders for the hearts and minds of people in South Asia and other places. And so, the Buddhists claimed, many of them, not all of them, that the truth was anatman. There is no self, there is no soul. That we believe we are individual persons now, but actually there is no self, there is no soul. What's interesting is that the second lecture given by Buddha himself, Siddhartha Gautama, his second lecture in Benares, near Benares, the Deer Park, is called, in Buddhism, the lecture on the non-existence of the soul. And the most interesting thing about the lecture is that Buddhist does not say there's no soul. But I guess many Buddhists didn't notice that. Some of them did. So, Buddha is saying you're not this, it was called the via negativa, you're not this, you're not that, you're not the physical body, you're not the material mind, you're not your material emotions, and so on. He doesn't deny an eternal soul. But many branches of Buddhism, there were many different schools of Buddhism in India, it's a very interesting story. At one time, Buddhism was a very prominent part of Indian civilization, in fact built probably the first great universities in the world, long before they existed in Europe. So, but this idea that became popular, that there is no self, there is no soul, when you become enlightened, you stop being an individual person. And shunyata, there's simply nothing ultimately, nirvana. Whatever they meant by that, and they still haven't decided what they meant by that. But anyway, that's a long story, which we won't go into now, what they meant by that word shunyata. So, then Shankara came along. Shankara came along, Adi Shankara, Shankaracharya, and for example, just like nowadays in America, and in India for that matter, most people in this country believe in God, most people in this country have certain ideas about right and wrong, and you have a sort of a small minority, last time you're coming in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the last time. So you have a small minority academic subculture which tends to have different views, which tends, for example, to be more cynical and skeptical, and to naively think their skepticism is somehow in and of itself intellectual. And so you had a similar situation in India. Now, because people that teach have influence beyond their numbers, I mean, obviously, if you have 1,000 professors in a city, they may have more influence, let's say, than 1,000 plumbers. Not necessarily more influence in plumbing, but more influence in terms of what people think. And so in India, you had this situation where most people, on the ground, as they say, in daily life, actually were worshipping some personal form of a deity, bhakti movements and so on. But in the Indian universities, among the intellectual elite, there tended to be this denial of person, denial of a personal God. In fact, even in Shankara, who restored in intellectual circles, this was a very small group, by the way. The world used to be very different than it is now. We have to think our way back. Just like if you read, let's say, early 19th century English novels that talk about ladies and gentlemen, they were a small minority of the population. So the people in India who were discussing Vedanta, the debates that were going on between Buddhist philosophers and, say, Shankar and his followers, this is going on among a very small number of people. But still, they were, intellectually very sophisticated. So in these intellectual circles, there tended to be a denial, ultimately, of a personal God. Even Shankara, who, against Buddhist philosophers, restored the validity of the Vedas, that was his contribution. Even Shankara says that when Maya, when avidya, ignorance, illusion, strikes the soul thinks that he or she is in a world with variety, with colors, that there's a God. The Ishwara is something that we imagine in illusion. And it's a very practical illusion. It's a very functional illusion. It's a healthy, pious illusion. But once you actually become fully enlightened, there is no separate Ishwara. There is no Ishwara and Jiva. No God and soul. So even Shankara, and more so his followers, Shankara ultimately was, you could say, a Krishna Bhakta. Shankara wrote his Gita Mahatmya, in which he glorifies Krishna. He glorifies Krishna and worships Krishna. So it has been argued that Shankara himself is sort of a closet Vaishnava. But just as Buddha's followers went beyond Buddha in denying the soul, Shankara's followers went beyond Shankara in denying a personal God, and denying that there is an individual soul. Now it's interesting, and this is the point I wanted to get at, to tie up what I said earlier, is that despite all these attempts, I would say the most powerful, sustained, sophisticated intellectual attempts in history.
Everybody in the middle.
Yeah, move over this way. Maybe next time
we
should.
Everybody in the middle, everybody move back and move forward. Back and forward.
They always come late like this?
Yes.
Huh?
And to the left.
What time? What time is it now?
8:00.
What time is the program advertised to begin?
By 7:00. We begin at 7:00.
Okay. So, in India, we find that, again, the most powerful, intellectually powerful, sustained, systematic attempts to deny the ultimate reality of the individual soul and the ultimate reality of a personal God, those attempts were made in India. There's nothing, I think, comparable in any other part of the world. If you look at Buddhist philosophy, the philosophy of the Shankara school and so on. And yet, despite all these attempts, doing everything intellectually possible and imaginable to deny the ultimate existence of a personal soul and a personal God, it failed completely. It's like those clowns where you punch them and they go down and bounce back up. First, what actually happened? First of all, look at Buddhism. Despite these, in early Buddhism in India, these attempts to this anatma doctrine, no self, no soul, anishwaravad, atheism. What happened is that the Buddhist world in India and outside was completely overwhelmed by a movement called Mahayana Buddhism. And in this Mahayana Buddhism, they began, first of all the Vedic gods came rushing back into Buddhist culture. In fact, it's said that, let's say, within approximately 1,000 years after Siddhartha Gautama, Buddha, Buddhism in India had practically merged back into Hinduism. It was becoming indistinguishable from Hinduism. Because in the Mahayana tradition, which today is 85% of the practice of the Buddhists in the world, or more, the highest perfection is to be a bodhisattva. What is a bodhisattva? It's a person who, out of compassion, gives up their own moksha, their own liberation, to come back life after life, to save others, to help others. This is very personal. First of all, how do you come back if you're not a person? If you aren't a person, who comes back? I mean, how do you know it's you? Even in these popular Buddhist stories, the Jataka stories about the previous lives of the Buddha, like in his previous life, Buddha was this, and in a past life that, and hundreds of lives, but if there's no person, who is it that's getting reborn again and again? And compassion is a very personal quality. Compassion is a personal quality. So if we're ultimately not persons, why does Mahayana Buddhism place the highest possible value on personal qualities and personal relationships? And despite all the talk about, you know, we're not really persons, even in Buddhist monasteries, they were extremely concerned about their families, for example. Where did my mother go when she passed away? Where is my grandfather? And so what you can see is that because we experience our life as persons, if we really just think, like, who am I? We really are persons. And in the open and free marketplace of ideas, which India was, if you're in an ancient Indian village, let's say 2,000 years ago, you're just in a village because India was, the whole world was basically rural back then. So let's say you're just in some village somewhere in India thousands of years ago. And someone in your neighbor, let's say one of your neighbors is Hindu, and you're a Buddhist. And let's say someone in your family, someone you love passes away, and it turns out that when the Hindu people pass away, they go to heaven, and their children can join them someday. And in Buddhism, well, where did my parents go? Oh, we don't know. Your parents don't really exist anyway. That is not the right answer. And so the point is that religion, historically, when it's not violently, coercively imposed upon people, is market-driven. And what you find is Buddhism, in the free and open environment of India, where people actually had religious, political, and social freedom, that it drifted right back toward the Hindu side, and it again became a personal movement. Because that's who we are. And these highly intellectual, counterintuitive, and ultimately unsatisfying ideas that we're not persons, and there is ultimately no conscious person watching over us who made the world, ultimately, people were not satisfied in India, and they rejected it. Even the Buddhists rejected it. And suddenly you come up with Buddhist paradises and Buddhist heavens and all the Vedic gods and perpetual life for individual souls as bodhisattvas and even omniscient beings, and it goes on and on and on. Now, if you look at Shankara, Shankara, of course, I think the reason Shankara is so popular in India is because no one actually knows what his philosophy is. That's another topic. I don't want to go into that now. But when you really get into it, it is, I would respectfully challenge anyone to make real sense of it once I explain what he actually said. That there are two levels of reality. And so everything that you now experience, in other words, being a person, there are other people. There's your mother, your father, your brothers, there are your friends, other people. There's a ceiling, there's a floor, there are walls. There are grammatical distinctions like nouns, verbs, adjectives, and so on. There are different notes of music. There are ratios of sound, which we call harmony. In other words, every kind of variety that exists ultimately doesn't exist. But it doesn't not exist. But it doesn't exist. And when you become enlightened, you'll see that it's actually only Brahman. Now, basically, what Shankara does is he takes about 1% or less, probably maybe like a much smaller fraction of 1% of all the Vedic statements and says these are true and everything else is ultimately an illusion. Although Shankara is obviously within the Vedanta tradition. Within the Vedanta tradition, which includes the Upanishads, Shruti Prasthan, the Brahma Sutras, Nyaya Prasthan, and the Bhagavad Gita, Smriti Prasthan, and although these books are full of nothing but variety, different words, God, souls, mountains, rivers, different people, different places, you could say 99.9% of all the statements in the Vedas talk about variety, and ultimately Shankara says that that doesn't exist. So he's taking a tiny fraction of 1% of the Vedic statements and saying only these things are real, and yet he claims he's explaining the Vedas. For example, Shankara says there are no parts. There's just the one whole, Brahman, because Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. And yet Bhagavad Gita, which Shankara worshipped and accepted because that's part of the Vedanta apparatus. Vedanta means the Upanishads, Brahma Sutras, and Bhagavad Gita. That is Vedanta. In the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, Krishna explicitly says, Mamaivamsichivaloke. Every soul is part of me, and Shankara says no parts. So, according to the Vaishnava tradition, Shankara is actually a great soul who was restoring Vedic authority to India in intellectual circles at a time when the Buddhists had more or less rejected it. Sorry, we're not eating yet.
Sorry. Yeah.
So, so what's interesting is that despite all this preaching, there are no parts, there are no individual souls, that the Ishwara, God, is ultimately an illusion. Because every differentiated thing, Shankara's philosophy is Nirguna Brahma. Now, to say Jiva and Ishwara, this is a soul, that's God, those are qualities, those are parts. Shankara rejects that. And therefore, even Ishwara, ultimately, is a delusion. Ignorance. God is ignorance. Don't kill the messenger. That's what he says. So, but what was going on in India? Despite this, the intellectual influence of Shankara, despite the fact that he is very much honored as a great philosopher, in fact, it was the bhakti movements that were sweeping over India. Either the Shakta, Shaiva, and the most powerful of all, Vaishnava. Why? Because ultimately we are persons. And you can, and even among Shankara's followers, they ended up doing their closet puja. Because you cannot philosophize away reality. You cannot philosophize away reality. And the reality is, we are individual conscious beings, and if you take if you take Vedanta, the Vedanta Sutra, the very first statement is, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now, we should try to understand the Absolute Truth. And then the definition of the Absolute Truth, Brahman, is Janmadyasya Jataha. The Absolute Truth is that from which everything comes. The source of everything. Now, there was a doctrine which Shankara accepted, and it was accepted as definitely a Vedic principle, called Satkaryavada. Satkaryavada means, and we accept it even in modern science, that a cause is present in the effect. If you're doing medical research, for example, you start with the effect, which is a disease, and you try to reason your way back to the cause. If you are a historian, you start with an effect. Something happened, like a war, or an economic boom. You start with the effect, and you reason back to the cause. If you are an insurance adjuster, and you're coming to investigate an accident, to check the skid marks and the dents in the car, you start with the effect, and you reason back. So, chronologically, things move in a certain direction, but analysis reverses the time arrow. And therefore, this is called, in Sanskrit, they knew about this thousands of years ago, this is called Satkaryavada, that the cause is present in the effect. Therefore, since this entire universe, and since we ourselves are effects, what is the cause? What is the cause of this effect, which we call reality? And so, given the fact that we are all individual conscious beings, no matter how much someone, for some reason which totally escapes me, may try to philosophically destroy themselves, it actually escapes me. Maybe it's like people in ancient monasteries with too much time on their hands. But why someone would want to meditationally or philosophically kill themselves, destroy their freedom, destroy their individuality in the name of nirvana or in the name of nirguna brahma, annihilate themselves as free individual persons, it escapes me. But somehow some people thought that was a great project. Anyway, so Ramanuja, whom we talked about today, actually, some of you must be from South India, right? Anyone here from Tamil Nadu? Yes. Anyway, we talked about your guy today. The great Ramanuja, who I think, without doubt, if you look at this very impressive and sophisticated intellectual history, I mean, Indian philosophers in ancient times understood perfectly well that whatever view you put forward with language. And therefore, they made by far the most sophisticated study of language in history. And so, I mean, they were so keenly aware of the relationship between language and ideas, so they studied language, they studied ideas, they studied consciousness as the ultimate medium and the ultimate instrument by which any idea arises. So in this, I think, almost uniquely advanced intellectual society, what we find is that again and again and again, it comes back to the simple truth that we are persons and somehow there is a purushottama. There is an ultimate person that accounts for our existence as we now know it. And even though we may be an illusion in the sense that, you know, we're a little obfuscated right now, we don't exactly understand what the highest reality is, but that common, and this is Ramanuja. You get, for example, Nagarjuna, who is obviously Indian, the great Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna, who says there's no whole, there's only parts. You get Shankara, who says there are no parts, there's only a whole. And finally, you get some common sense. Ramanuja, who comes and says, duh, you know, there's a whole and there's parts. For example, you have a family, the family's a whole, there's parts of the family. Your body has parts, but there is a body. If we study the nature of reality, we find there are parts and there are wholes. And so Ramanuja also says that ultimately we are persons, we are individual, because we come from a supreme individual person, Purushottama. I mean, Krishna himself says this in Bhagavad Gita. It could not be more explicit. At the end of chapter 15, Krishna says that Dhavima Purushau Loke Kshadak Chakshadas Evacha Charak Sarva Bhutani Kuta Stakchara Uchate, which means that in this world there are two Purushas, which is Sankhya, jargon. It means two kinds of souls in this world. The conditioned soul, the soul that is dying because of identifying with the temporary body, and the soul that is kutastha, that stands at the peak, the enlightened soul, who is beyond this illusion, and therefore is not dying because that soul is on the eternal platform. Now Krishna says these are the two kinds of souls. And then he says, uttama purushas tvanya, but the greatest person is someone else. And so the idea in this nirguna brahma, that if you become enlightened, you become yourself, like tattvamasi, you become God. Krishna completely rejects it. I mean, despite its own intrinsic absurdity, the idea that we are originally God, but somehow we just became stupid accidentally. And so therefore we're down in this material world, acting in very ungodly ways. Now there's only one thing, right? Brahman. There's nothing but Brahman. There's only one thing. Well then, what about ignorance? Isn't ignorance a second thing? And not only is there a second thing called ignorance, because practically the most important term in Shankara's teaching is avidya, not only is there a second thing, but the second thing is winning. I mean, let's do a real quick count. I mean, how many totally enlightened people do you know, and how many un-totally enlightened people do you know? So not only is there a second thing called avidya, ignorance, but ignorance is winning. So how are we God? So anyway, Ramanuja explained all these things. And Krishna says, Uttama Purushas Tvanya, Uttama Purusha, Purushottam, is someone else. It's not the enlightened soul. Someone may be an enlightened soul, but that is not the Purushottama. That's exactly what Krishna says. Uttama Purusha Tvanya Paramatma Dharita. And that Uttama Purusha is called Paramatma. We may be Atma, as in the Upanishads. We may be souls. We are souls, but we are not Paramatma. Paramatma Udharita. Jo Loka Trayama Visha Vibharati Abhiya Ishwara. So Krishna says, that is the Lord. That is the Ishwara. The Purushottama. The Paramatma. And then Krishna says, Jasmat aham, jasmat kshar tito ham, aksharar apichottama, tasmat loke vede cha pratita, atosmi loke vede cha pratita purushottama. Krishna says, yeah, Krishna identifies himself that I am the Ishwara, because I am beyond the conditioned soul, and also beyond the liberated soul. So if someone is thinking, if someone is so ambitious and vain that they're thinking that when I become enlightened I'll be God, I have bad news for you, because Krishna says that because I am beyond the conditioned soul and beyond the enlightened soul, therefore in the world and in the Veda, loke vede cha pratita, I am celebrated as Purushottama. Now, someone may say, that's well and good, but that but beyond the Purushottama, maybe there's some Nirakar Brahman. Krishna also covers that base. Krishna makes he really nails down all the possible, you know, points and covers all the bases. Krishna is actually very intelligent. So then Krishna says, Jo mam eva masumudho janati Purushottamam sa sarvavid bhajati mam sarva bhavena bharata. Krishna says that one who thus knows me as Purushottama, not this nonsense that, okay, very good, Krishna's Purushottama, and beyond the Purushottama there's something else. No. Krishna says one who knows me as Purushottama knows everything. That's it. He knows, he or she knows everything if they know Purushottama. And bhajati mam sarva bhavena bharata, and such a person devotes themselves to me. Now you may say, well, that's simply Bhagavad Gita. Well, simply Bhagavad Gita. Anyway. Then Krishna says, iti guhyatamam shastram. This is the most advanced shastra. This is the most... So Krishna really is making a very strong argument. And Shankara, who's actually a great soul, but he had a particular historical mission. He took the Vedic culture back as far as he could take it, given the fact that intellectual culture in India at the time was dominated by Buddhist theories. Just as I said, in America at the present time, there's an academic subculture which is very different from what most people in the country think. So anyway, this is Bhagavad Gita, that is Vedanta, and Krishna. So we invite you to try to seriously understand Krishna. The most, you could say, the most, the best philosophers, the greatest thinkers, have accepted Krishna. And so we should try to understand who Krishna really is. Not merely in a sentimental way. We should have some sentiment, bhakti means devotion. But we should try soberly, seriously, intelligently to understand who Krishna really is. The idea that Krishna is a Hindu god is, of course, a ludicrous idea. Because how can you be a... I mean, it's almost like saying that, you know, Krishna, he, you know, it's like saying there's an Indian prime minister who has no political authority here, And the American president has no political authority in India. So is Krishna just like some local thing that... I mean, how could you be a Hindu god? I mean, it seems to me if you're God, that's just what you are. It's like saying there's a Hindu sun or a Hindu law of gravity. In fact, the word Hindu, as you know, is a mispronunciation of a geographical term. There is a river, which now, of course, goes through Pakistan, called Sindhu. In ancient times, it was called the Sindhu River. And so people living west of that river, Persian civilization, they pronounced an S at the beginning of a word as an H, so they called it Hindu. That's where, by the way, you get the Greek word homo, as in homogeneous. It's the Sanskrit somo. The S goes to H. So, anyway, so the people west of the river called the river the Hindu River. And the people on that side of the river were the Hindus. It was a geographic term. It was not a religious term. And in Greece, of course, they did not pronounce it. So you get this whole linguistic thing. In Persia, an initial S is an H. So Sindhu becomes Hindu. In Greece, which is, you know, going next door, one door down from the Persian Empire, an initial H is not pronounced, like an English word honor or hour. Like what, you know, how many hours? And so, therefore, Indus became India. Or Indica. So the word Hindu, as I said, was a geographic term. It was a geographic term which only became used, in fact, when the Muslims invaded India, they called everybody that wasn't a Muslim a Hindu. So everyone in India, no matter what their religion was, whether they were Sikh or Buddhist or Hindu, they were just Hindus. And gradually it became used as a religious term. Anyway, that's a whole history of how the term became used, how the concept of it became changed. And what, if you study the history of the self-understanding, the history of the self-understanding of people in South Asia, people who accepted the Vedas as authoritative, that's a whole topic, that's a whole history, and how it changed in modern times. So that nowadays we have a notion which has very little historical depth. So the modern way of conceiving of these things is actually a modern way of conceiving of these things. And one of the purposes of the Krishna consciousness movement is to revive and restore the actual Vedic understanding of who we are and what the world is and what religion is. So, anyway, all of you, some of you already come regularly, invite everyone to come and take advantage of this great facility and learn about Krishna and learn about Vedic culture. So any questions now? Yes.
Can you cover till Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from Ramanacharya so that we get the whole thing covered?
People may get very hungry if I do all that. So,
just the change of.
Yeah, maybe we'll do it next time. Maybe because that's a. Maybe just very quickly.
Yeah.
Of course, you have Ramanuja, Vishishta Advaita, then you have the great Madhvacharya, Advaita philosophy, and then ultimately Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, whom we accept as Krishna. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you all know this, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, that whenever, basically human civilization is collapsing, dharma is not a Hindu idea. Dharma means the laws of nature. And there are laws governing human conduct. There are psychological principles. There are sociological principles. Dharma is the universal law. It's not simply some quaint Hindu idea. And so when Krishna says, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, when dharma is declining, he means when human civilization is declining. And abhyutanama dharmasya, and incivility is increasing. Then Krishna says, tadatmanam sajamiham, then I come myself. So, then Krishna says, paritranaya sadhyunam, basically to save good people, and vinashaya cha duskritam, to remove people who are actually doing evil in the world. And dharma sangsthapanarthaya, and to restore dharma. Sambhavami yuge yuge. I come in every age. So this is Krishna's promise. And in this age, our understanding is that Krishna indeed has kept his promise and come as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And so there's a statement about him, that if you read Bhagavad Purana, which talks about the different avatars of Krishna. Today, by the way, is the avatar Mahotsav Titi. It's the day of Varaha. So Krishna says, I come in every age, and he actually does. And in this age, Yajnaya Sankirtana Prayarya Jantihi Sumedasa. It's Hari Sankirtan, which we are doing here. So we are doing this, chanting, we're doing it because this is Yuga Dharma. This is actually the Yuga Dharma for this age, this glorious Kali Yuga. And today is actually the appearance day of Varaha Avatar. Krishna is actually very playful. It's not that God, people sometimes think God comes as Krishna, which is a complete misunderstanding. It's that Krishna comes as God. In the sense that we have a formal idea of God as majestic and so on. Of course, God is great. But actually, it's not that God appears as Krishna, he really is Krishna. And that's what Krishna is trying to explain to us in Bhagavad Gita. There's nothing like it. I mean, people, I was once speaking at the main Hindu temple in Knoxville, Tennessee. And on the back wall of the mandir, they had a poster saying, like, it was who's who in Hinduism, like explaining for their congregation. It was a very interesting idea, because it had all these different forms that we all know, Krishna or Shiva, Narayan, so on, Rama. And then it said, all of these are incarnations of the Ishwara, that there is a generic Ishwara who has no specific name or no specific form, no specific activities, and this sort of generic Ishwara specifically manifests in different forms. This is exactly the opposite of what Krishna says, by the way. It's exactly the opposite of what Krishna says. Krishna says that he's the Ishwara, and Krishna says, avyaktam vyaktimapanam manyante mangabhudaya. Literally, Krishna says, people who have no intelligence, abhudi. People who have no intelligence think that I am an invisible something, invisible God, that takes on the form of Krishna. Now, this is a popular idea, but Krishna says people who think this way have no intelligence. Because actually, it is Krishna. If you read Mahabharata, if you read Bhagavad Gita, if you read so many Vedic literatures, you find that there is a nitya, divya, rupa. There's an eternal, divine form, Krishna. That's really him. And so that's the message. It's really him. It's really Krishna. And that's what Krishna's trying to teach us in Bhagavad Gita. Anyway, I could go on all night giving you more explanations and slokas and so on, but that's the basic idea. Yes, in the back, do you have a question?
Prabhupada said that Nirvana, that's finished.
Nirvana is a grammatically negative term. Nir in Sanskrit means without. So I think that's already a problem when your highest goal is grammatically negative. When your highest goal is that you don't have this. What do you have? And actually, 2,500 years after the appearance of Buddha, they're still trying to figure out what it means. Because Nirvana is not the assertion of a positive existence. It's grammatically a negative term. Grammatically negative. It means that it's a state where you don't have this. But what do you have? Interestingly, Shankara, you know, trying to sort of take back intellectual momentum from the Buddhists on behalf of the Vedic culture, comes up with a competing negative term. Because apparently in those days, you know, that's... I mean, you can see it nowadays among so-called intellectuals. Skepticism is sort of very sexy. So... just as the Buddhists had their negative term, Nirvana, so Shankara came up with his own competing negative term, Nirguna Brahma, the absolute without guna. So finally Ramanuja came and said, hey everybody, it's actually positive, and talked about the Ishwara. Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned that the society was much more agrarian or rural.
Everywhere in the world.
But we know that there was Hastinapur, there was Dwarka.
Yeah, but those cities were also not on the scale of modern big cities, and most people didn't live in the cities.
But we did also Prabhupada had the, and Prabhupada insisted that the word, not Shankara Pavaka, that the word electricity would be there also.
I don't think Prabhupada insisted. We don't have time for that now. But that's a whole discussion of our hermeneutic, our systematic approach to understanding Prabhupada's language, and I'd be happy to talk to you about that, but that's a whole other topic about, I think there are logical, convincing ways to understand Prabhupada's use of language, and his own philosophy of historiography, and so on and so forth. So maybe we'll stop now, and then we'll sort of, what does happen now?
Kirtan?
Yes, Kirtan, and then... Okay, thank you all very much. Hope we'll see you again. Hare Krishna.